Okay. We're going to be looking at the last seven verses that deal with the judgeship of Jephthah, and this is where it properly starts. And verse 1 records the complaint of Ephraim, and that's the tribe. And the men of Ephraim were gathered together. Now, the Hebrew word for together is actually indicating with hostile intent. And so they wanted to burn down his house. And so they crossed over to Sophon, which means they crossed over to the Jordan, confronted Jephthah in the village of Sophon, which is mentioned in Joshua 13, verse 27. And they issue a complaint to him. Why did you cross over and fight against the sons of Ammon all by yourself without calling us to you? Now, the tribe of Ephraim is the largest tribe. We see that in Numbers chapter 1, verse 32 to 33. And they considered themselves to be the most important tribe, and so failing to go to war seems to be an insult. And so they seem to be a problem. Hey, you didn't ask us, we're now going to harass you. And so because they felt insulted, they posed that threat to Jephthah, we will burn down your house over you with fire. In other words, while you're inside your house, we will burn it down. The contrast here with the godly men and the ungodly people is very clear. The threat is to kill Jephthah by burning him and his house down. Now, if you read Judges 14, verse 15, you do see that happening. So it is a very hostile, real threat that is happening. Now, the tribe of Ephraim has a history of complaining. They express a dissatisfaction about the allotted land that Joshua divides up. When we look at Joshua 17, verses 14 to 16, they are dissatisfied in the book of Judges in chapter 8 when they took offense at Gideon for not summoning them to battle early on with the Midianites. And now they find fault with Jephthah. Gideon had managed to appease them, Jephthah does not appease them. Instead, there is trouble ahead. He becomes responsible for the death of 42,000. Now, in verses 2 to 3, we see Jephthah's response to Ephraim. And he clarified the actual situation, stating, I and my people were in great strife. These are the worthless men, or the men who were empty. We were in great strife with the sons of Ammon. And when I called you, it's in the plural, you, you saved me not out of their hands. In other words, when I called initially, you did not come, which is what the Ephraimites conveniently ignore. And whether he generally called for their assistance, he's certainly indicating that he did call for them and that they failed to respond. In verse 3, he then recounts the victory over the Ammonites, highlighting the timing from his perspective. And when I saw that you, plural, you did not save me, I put my life in my hands and I passed over against the sons of Ammon, and the Lord delivered them into my hands. And so he once again restates, you didn't come up, you didn't come up. So to summarize, Jephthah makes his response, his defense clear. He emphasizes the intense conflict with Ammon. He accuses them of ignoring his initial call. He then highlights his own initiative, his bravery in face of the trouble with the Ammonites. Fourthly, he credits God. And then he challenges the Ephraimites' hostile aggression towards him. Now, this dispute descends into a tribal war. And this is one of the first tribal wars that we encounter. The recently disbanded army is now recalled to arms and to confront the internal threat rather than the external threat. Then Jephthah gathered together all the men of Gilead and fought with Ephraim. And this marks Jephthah's second victory, and the men of Gilead smote Ephraim. And this act of vengeance was provoked by an insult, because they said, "You are fugitives of Ephraim, you Gileads." Now, all of this is in the plural. Ye are fugitives, ye Gileadites. And so this taunt is inflammatory, that the soldiers are willing to regroup for a second significant battle. Essentially, they were saying, "You Gileadites are nothing more than the rubble of the Ephraimite runaways. You're an insignificant group dwelling within the territories of the most esteemed tribe, Ephraim and Manasseh. You may fancy yourself as brave soldiers, but you know better than the most contemptible Ephraimites who deserted in time of war." And so they're accused of being rubble. And in verses 5 to 6 comes that slaughter. And the narrative details that slaughter, and Gileadites took the fords of the Jordan before the Ephraimites. Their aim was to prevent that the remnant would escape the battlefield. Ironically, it was the Ephraimites who, under Gideon's command, had previously seized the fords of the Jordan to cut off the Midianites, Judges 7:24. Now that same tactic was employed against them, against the Ephraimites. And rather than Jephthah and the Gileadites being fugitive, now it is Ephraim who's the fugitive. So there's a lot of play being made here. Now, if they captured an individual and denied being an Ephraimite, a test was administered, and they would say, "Now say Shibboleth." The Hebrew word Shibboleth has two potential meanings. It can refer to an ear of corn or an ear of wheat, as in Genesis 41, 5 to 6. Or it can signify the flood of a stream, Psalm 69, verse 3. And the latter aligns more closely with the context of the river fords that are there. Now, the Ephraimites had a dialectical disability. They were not able to say Shibboleth, but would pronounce it Sibboleth. And as you can see, in the way it's written in Hebrew, it starts with a different letter, but the shin and the sin would be pronounced the same way, or it being the same letter. But here it is the samach, it's a different letter. But the text clearly says it is about pronunciation. They couldn't say Shibboleth, but say Sibboleth. And so if somebody failed to pronounce it rightly, and they were apprehended and killed right there at the forts of the Jordan. "Are you an Ephraimite?" "No, then say Shibboleth." Now, we in World War II had a similar thing in the Netherlands. We would say to the Germans, say Scheveningen, and they would say Scheveningen, and it sounded very similar to them, but you could hear the difference if you were Dutch, and you go, "You're not one of us." And while Germans often were able to speak reasonable Dutch, it was one of those words that they struggled with. Mm-hmm. Now, the total men that are killed here are 42,000. And that's a lot of people. At the time of Ephraim fell, 42,000. Jephthah judged then Israel for another 6 years, and then he dies, and he's buried in one of the cities of Gilead. One of the cities, this is kind of interesting, because normally you would say where he's buried, but in one of the cities, in the plural, Ba'arei Gilead, rather than in this city. And so it's kind of interesting. It gives rise to lots of rabbinic speculation that His body was divided here and there and everywhere. But the reality is he's just buried in one of those places. And so the life of Jephthah comes to an end. The Gileadite, born prostitute, rejected by his half-brothers, to become a mighty warrior, called upon by God to lead Israel and deliver Israel from the hands of the Ammonites. And so I believe he is a true hero of the faith, and I hope we stop maligning him in our sermons and in our thoughts. Anyway, that's all I have to say about that. And I'd like to hear what you think, or what you think. Or maybe we have no questions at all.
Is that earlier on, Don, can we put Mark back on?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, sorry, Paul. In number 6, where it talks about the Nazarite vow, it clearly says whether woman or man undertake it. But other than Jephthah's daughter, there's no examples up until Samuel's time. Is there any other?
That's true. There's no examples, but there are not many who are actually called Nazarites. Mm. And so, in that sense, Samson is a clear example of that. John the Baptist is, but I think Anna probably took that same vow. It's just not recorded. Mm. They're just not. Later on in Rabbinic, we do read about certain rabbis who take that vow. But I think most of them would have taken that vow for a short period of time, months, and then after that period is over, or perhaps 6 months, they would have then gone back to their former life, and it would have been over. And so they start separating themselves.
Mm. Yeah. Rather than that lifelong dedication.
Yeah. You also find the term in Amos chapter 2. Mm-hmm. And obviously in the New Testament, in Acts 21, when Paul visits Jerusalem and they say, pay for these men who are taking this vow of purification, and it's in there, it's not, it's rare that you actually see mentioned at all. Mm.
I've got a question, Paul. In, if we look at the Assyrian captivity, the Babylonian captivity, they would kill so many people, but they always took back a large amount of people to blend in their own country and to work as free labour. Why isn't this happening with Jephthah and his neighbouring nations against him? Everyone that wants to feud against him, there's always a big big battle and you don't hear of anyone being held captive. They're wiped out.
Yeah, it's not recorded in every battle that they did that, but you do find it in the Minor Prophets. If you look at Obadiah accuses Edom of selling. I'm just trying to see if I can find it so quickly. Obadiah chapter 1, that's really only one chapter, but in verse 11, on the day you stood aloof, on the day that strangers carried off his wealth and foreigners entered his gates and cast lots. And so you do find it at other times that they do that. And Obadiah is accusing Edom of just standing by, because it was a common practice. But you would kill some, and so you would kill a portion of the men, and you would take a portion of the people out. Now, what you don't want to do is take the men out. You want to reduce their strength. You want to rape the women, because then the offspring is considered of your tribe.
So, and so but Jacob's sons did the Shechem.
And so that's the common thing to do.
Yeah, the kings of the north, when they took Sodom, with Lot among them, took them north, and Abram had to go and rescue people. And the king said, give me the people, you keep the property. And Abram said, no, thank you. It's there, it's just not, like the Nazirite women, not made a big deal, big mention of. It is in the background, yeah. How much of Ephraim's pride would stem from Joshua having been of their tribe?
How much is a good question. That's I don't think we really know how much, but there's a consistency that they complain that they should be considered the bigger tribe, the more important tribe.
And a constant battle between them and Judah across the judges.
Yeah.
Into Samuel.
So, so that's it. I do think that there is a significant amount of pride there, but exactly how much that is.
Yeah. It's just one of many planks in the port fence.
I mean, they were the largest tribe. And so it makes sense that they should have preeminence based on numbers, based on human thinking. And that's what they display.
You know, when Jephthah made his vow, I always wonder how much he half expected his daughter to come out and greet him. Because he says, whatever comes out and greets. And not many of the animals are going to do that. There has to be a fairly high chance that it's going to be a family member of some sort.
If he is under the inspiration of the Spirit, then it makes sense. Normally you would expect a dog to come running towards you, or a person, but not most animals wouldn't. Like, I don't think a goat or a sheep generally would come after you. So it is an unusual wording that we have.
Anyone else with comments, thoughts, questions? Joyce, Grace?
Paul, I have a question, Paul. The use of this phrase, living sacrifice today, what kind of meaning can you get from there? Is it just a metaphorical meaning, or when someone says somebody's a living sacrifice, like we saw what happened in the Old Testament, how do we see it used today?
I think there are some people who've been given over to live a living sacrifice, and so I hate to point at a particular example, but I think of people like Cliff Richard, who clearly is demonstrating in his life that he said, I'm not going to get married because I want to live for the Lord. And so whether he's a good example, I don't know. I've never met him. But from what I know, I think that would be the kind of example I would use. There are people who become missionaries. And so think about Richard and Heather's children. who've gone out to places where you go, wow, I wouldn't want to go there in 100 years, let alone be missionaries there. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I think it's people who go and be missionaries somewhere else, but sometimes I think they just dedicate their life and everything that they do is for the Lord. So for each person that'll be different. There's not a one rule fits all people. And if God has given you the gift of singleness, that might be the cross to bear. But it might be something that you can do. For me, that are the examples that come up in my mind. But who knows, there might be other examples that people have that might be better.
Yeah, but aren't we all, as believers, asked to live a living sacrifice, or, you know, that, I mean, whatever we have, what our hands find, what our feet, where our feet takes us, and, you know, it of course varies. Every one of us has been given different gifts, and, you know,
And I think you're right, but it's, if we are true living sacrifices, then it needs to be sacrificial living. You and I both know of Christians who are Christians in name, and so they're happy to meet us on Sunday morning.
But,
come Monday afternoon, brother, don't knock on my door, I'm busy. And so I think it's if you live a godly life, then you're already fulfilling that. Whether it's in the fullness of that phrase, I think that's something that only you can determine. And there might be seasons when you feel more like a living sacrifice than other times.
Thank you.
One thing that does encourage me with Jephthah's daughter is her obedience to her father, her submission to his authority. She didn't, like Isaac, didn't question, didn't complain, just asked for a bit of time and that's it. It shows a godly training of his daughter. So again, that speaks well of Jephthah's life example throughout his life, despite the desperate upbringing.
I think that's exactly right. It does speak into that godliness at home model.
Keith, Joy, Doreen?
For those of you who are still awake.
Sorry, I can't really talk much. I'm at a sleep clinic and they've got wires all over me. Much of my brain waves while I'm asleep. But I really like to talk about Jephthah. I listen to it. I never realised that. I could never work that out. I thought, how weird is that? That Jephthah sacrificed his daughter. But now it's all... Now, thank you for you clarified it. It makes sense now.
That's good.
It was dedicated to them. She was set aside, dedicated to the Lord.
There's a non-biblical reference as well in 2 Maccabees 3, verses 19 to 20. And there it uses the phrase, and the virgins also that were shut up, like or locked into the house, came forth, some to the high priest of Onias and some up to the walls, and looked out of the windows, holding up their hands towards heaven, making supplication. So you see a bit of a mixture there. There are virgins They are locked into the temple compound. They look towards heaven and hold up their hand to make supplication.
It is true.
Yeah. But that's clearly a non-biblical reference, but it does come out of the Second Temple period.
Yeah, it's a helpful illumination. Yeah. Joy or Doreen, any thoughts or comments?
Verses or this chapter is not very often heard of, so it's interesting to learn something today from this book.
Yeah, it's one of those stories that Sunday school teachers avoid. Whereas those of us that preach chapter by chapter, verse by verse, we can't avoid it.
But I think it's a chapter that we can preach if we understand it right. But sadly, because a very early on, both Jews and Christians have misunderstood it. And so there are some that do mispreach it and say he sacrificed her physically. And that would have been an abominable practice.
I always thought he just didn't know the word of God. I thought, Jasper, he got anointed with the Holy Spirit, but he had zeal without knowledge, you know, didn't know the Bible or the law.
It would have made sense if we didn't have his words. But in his words, he said, remember that God has given us this land. And so he's clearly indicating to the Ammonites that they were there already for 300 years in the land, but that God had given it. And so he does know at least some of the promises that are within. So I think it's more likely that he did know the word.
Doreen, are you going to make a comment or a question?
No, I was just going to say I'm happy listening to it. It's,
That's good. Thank you. We might call it a night there, Paul.